Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Carol Reardon is a professor of American history at Penn State and this year's Penn State laureate. A noted expert on the American Civil War, one of her best-known books is Pickett's Charge, In History and Memory. It provides a fascinating assessment of the facts and fiction surrounding the single most famous military battle of the Civil War. Carol Reardon, thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
You have been a Civil War buff since your very first trip to Gettysburg back in 1963. You were 10 years old, a third grader, I assume on a field trip. What was it about that very first visit to Gettysburg that was so captivating to you?
Well, actually, it was my next door neighbors. They were going to go and take the family, and they knew I had a little bit of an interest in history, so they asked me to come along. I just remember as a 10-year-old, we were getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning to go, and I had my first camera with me. And the photographs that I took on that first trip, I still have. They had to tell me to stop taking photographs too early. I was taking photographs of the 20 miles to Gettysburg sign, and they had to warn me.
You were excited.
I was excited. They had to warn me. You might want to wait until we actually get there. What it was, I'm not really quite sure, other than it was something related to the Civil War. It was the centennial, and it was close to home, and I was actually going to be able to see a part of the history that intrigued me. I was hooked from the moment I got there.
No, I have to say, the sad truth is that most school children are not similarly inspired. In fact, according to the nation's report card, the area in which U.S. students perform most poorly is U.S. history. In fact, only 12% of high school students in 2011 were proficient in U.S. history. Why do you suppose that's the case? Bad teaching, a problem with American school books? What is it?
Well, I think other subjects have gotten greater priority. Naturally, there's a great deal of interest in science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and things like that. A number of disciplines such as history and geography have all suffered as a consequence a little bit. My own interest didn't come from any curricular design or anything of the sort. My interest came from the fact that I am a child of a World War II veteran. Our current generation rising up don't come from parents with the same experiences that my parents had. And my father being a World War II armor officer who fought in the Pacific, my mother being the youngest of four children and her oldest brother was killed during the war. I grew up in a VFW post in Pittsburgh pretty much, and a lot of my interest doesn't come from a curriculum. It comes from inside here somewhere. And that's something that's very different. I found a passion early.
When you entered the profession in the 1980s, you were in some respects a lone ranger. There were not many women historians.
There were not many women in military history, that's for sure. My very first meeting at the Society for Military History, which is the major professional organization in my specialty, was 1989, and it was held at the Virginia Military Institute, which of course then was all male.
All men, right.
I walked in, realized that there were only about three or four women there, and a couple of them came with their husbands or significant others who were giving papers. And we realized how much of an oddity we were when something very fundamental came up. There were no ladies' rooms. It was an all-male school, and if you went into the classroom buildings where the papers were given or the auditorium or anything of the sort, there was a basic necessity that was lacking, and we had to deal with that. But from that point on, well, I just decided, this is what I want to do. They'll have to deal with it. I'm here. We're going to make this work.
And yet you actually started off in biology. Your undergraduate degree is biology, and it wasn't until graduate school that you studied history.
That little tickle of interest that I had as a child never really left. And I was fortunate that I went to a small liberal arts college, Allegheny College here in Pennsylvania, and found a wonderful mentor in the history department without even looking for one. And he had this wonderful practice of taking anybody who wanted to go, didn't have to be a history major or even in his class, would spend a long weekend in May down on the Civil War battlefields of Virginia. And I couldn't wait to go. Every year I was up there, I went on the trip. He didn't know who I was that first year, except I seemed to be on his heels the whole time. And the fact that every time he tried to tell a practical joke that was Civil War related, I either spoiled the punchline for him or if he would try to send folks to follow a trench line that ended up in a swamp, I was warning them off. And he couldn't quite figure out who was messing up all of his timing and all of his jokes, but it had to be somebody with some historical knowledge. Well, a war of wills became something much more important a couple years down the line when I went to him and said, I think I'm in the wrong business. I'm not trying to run away from the sciences. I was doing fine. I always say that it was my moment of clarity, when it was very clear in my own mind that I really wanted to be a historian.
And your favorite classroom is the battlefield at Gettysburg, which you have been to literally countless times, and in fact, you have moved to Gettysburg.
Best move I ever made. There's something about the place that gets you. I'm not the first one to say that. That's certainly not original to me. Many of the veterans who came back years and years and years later, they were the ones who said it. There's something about the place that gets you. Just so many people with so many different stories came there, had so many different experiences. Some thought it was simply the most important thing that they ever did in their entire lives. Other people come, and even today, they find something about Gettysburg that resonates with their own lives today. I'm always amazed, I'm always interested, and it's really fascinating to me the wide range of different ways in which Gettysburg somehow connects with them.
Well, not just Gettysburg, but we just this past April celebrated the 150th anniversary of the Civil War. So I'm wondering, a century and a half out, what is the impact and the ongoing relevance of the Civil War?
Well, many of the things about which we fought back 150 years ago remain open questions and open issues yet today. Abraham Lincoln at the beginning of the war said that this is a war for the Union, and the Union was preserved. You know, we occasionally hear talk of
secession
and that sort of thing even today. But an awful lot of the basic relationships between the federal government and the state government, the relationship between the governors and the governed, are still open issues we discuss today. So even though secession might not be the big issue, the basic relationship between government of the people, by the people, for the people, still hasn't been resolved in all of its bits and pieces. The other piece, of course, is as the war progressed, Abraham Lincoln also declared that abolition of slavery would become an aim of the war. And as recent events have played out, that issue certainly remains an element of public discourse today in all kinds of different ways.
Yes, yeah, so I'm curious to know how you would respond to the sentiment, the Civil War being described as a wound that never healed.
Well, there's a lot to that. Robert Penn Warren, a number of years ago, wrote a wonderful essay when he said that the Civil War is our only felt history. Usually we think about history. We develop our analytical tools. We talk about the importance of evaluating evidence and all that sort of thing. But there's something about the Civil War that oftentimes hits us on a different level. And we allow emotion to sometimes
overwhelm intellect.
And it happens a lot. By way of comparison, and I get this question a lot, I taught in the South for a few years before I came to Penn State. I only taught at the University of Georgia for 2 years, but over the course of 2 years, by actual count, I had 23 different students come up to me at one point or another and explain that they had an ancestor who fought in the Civil War. They oftentimes knew what company and what regiment he served in, could tell me what battles he fought in, could tell me if he was wounded. He could give me the entire family history on that soldier. And then he oftentimes had a question about either a battle or wonder why he fought because the family didn't own slaves or had another question. I'm in my 24th year here at Penn State, and I think my total count of students who have come to me in all that time is 5 right now. And there's just a different way of remembering and a different priority, I guess. So I think it matters where you live, how you're brought up. There's an awful lot of personal element as to why we still reflect on it today.
It's interesting because when you do stand on the battlefield at Gettysburg, you do it as, in a way, a forensic scientist. You look at all of the accounts that, for instance, the young students you were teaching in Georgia, in maybe letters or memorabilia they have from their own families, whether what they're recounting could possibly be accurate or not.
We get this kind of question a lot when I'm out dealing with the public. We have a lot of folks who have a basic interest. They know the bits and pieces about their family history, but they don't know how it fits into the bigger picture. There was a call-in show at the end of the 150th anniversary of Gettysburg, And I was taking calls from across the nation. And for some reason, it was all about their ancestors. And I was getting these wonderful phone calls from a gentleman from Alabama who wanted to know where his ancestor fought at Gettysburg, and that he was in the 28th Alabama. And he knew all the things that I was been describing. And I had to sit there and say, I'm sorry, sir, but your ancestor wasn't at Gettysburg. The 28th Alabama wasn't here. So either he made up stories about Gettysburg, or he's misremembering what regimental number it was. The 26 was there. Maybe that was the answer. But you could hear the disappointment in his voice. Oh, you know, just you could hear it. It really is an interesting opportunity to speak to folks who bring their cherished family stories with them. And when they find out and get the validation, oh, you mean he was right here? Well, let me tell you about that. Or those times when you have to say, I'm sorry.
Well, you bring up an interesting point, because there are a number of people who say that our history books, especially elementary school history books, they're extremely limited, they're often very biased, and in many cases they are flat out wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Even when historians know, for instance, that the story about Patrick Henry and his give me liberty or give me death speech from the Revolutionary War is not accurate, it gets printed year after year after year. Why do we continue to tell stories that we know not to be true?
Well, oftentimes when they appear in especially elementary books, history isn't really the purpose why they're telling the story. I remember as a child in Pittsburgh, one of my first readers, and the point was to get you to read, it was a series of mini biographies, and one of them was all about the young Robert E. Lee. Growing up in Virginia, he was a good, respectful boy who always did his lessons, and he was good to his mother, and he was, in all respects, a wonderful role model for a young person growing up. It took him off to West Point to be a cadet, but it never took him.
Where he was second in his
class. Yeah, absolutely. But it never took him into anything that was remotely controversial as far as resigning from the Union Army or serving in the Confederacy or anything about slavery or anything of the sort. But then again, that wasn't the point of the story. And so I think you have to take a look, first of all, what is the textbook's whole point?
Well, the whole point of one of your most popular books, Pickett's Charge in History and Memory, is really to issue a warning to historians to be very, very careful about what they write.
And hopefully not just historians. One of the talks that I'm giving this year as a university laureate, I've been advised to offer up several possibilities for talks, and one of them is History versus Heritage. And we could just as easily have named it History versus Memory, because we're essentially talking about the same thing. History is an intellectual force. It's an analytical force. We're seeking something called the objective truth. We might not reach it all because we have to base it on evidence, not a whim, not an agenda, anything of the sort. You can only take your argument as far as the evidence will let you take it. On the other hand, you have heritage or memory, which is oftentimes selective, sentimentalizing, sanitizing, self-aggrandizing. It usually serves an agenda, and it's usually based in emotion. There's usually a point, a reason why you're telling the story. And what we have to be careful when we read about, whether it's Gettysburg or any historical event or anything about the past, is whether you are seeing the operation of history or the operation of memory at work. And oftentimes, and here's where it gets tricky, oftentimes they blend together. Sometimes they follow parallel paths,
mix, right?
And sometimes they just go off in completely different directions. It's fun to watch sometimes.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia, and our guest is Carol Reardon, a leading expert on the American Civil War and this year's Penn State laureate.
So how does memory shape and over time reshape our perceptions of the past?
Well, you never quite know, and that's what makes it such a dangerous thing. There's not a predictable way that heritage or memory will reshape the past. Usually the story that comes out says more about the time when the story is created than about the original historical event. Case in point, this whole event called Pickett's Charge. Pickett's Charge, the name, is really a media creation. Pickett's men didn't call it that, and Pickett never called it that. The Richmond newspapers in the weeks right after the battle wanted to talk about their hometown troops Pickett's men were all Virginians from Central and Piedmont, Virginia, and Tidewater, Virginia. And there are five Richmond newspapers who want you to read their newspaper. So they're going to talk about the hometown boys. And everybody knows that they're under Pickett. So the charge of Pickett's division, Pickett's men, Pickett's charge. And it gets hooked. But they're only half the men in the charge. What about the rest of them?
Not only what about the rest of them, that's occurred on the third day of the mm-hmm. Battle of Gettysburg. What about the
first
day
2 days?
And the second day and the commanders in those battles?
Yeah, and it just gets down to that one little event. And, well, just to give you an idea of how the forgotten half fought back, first of all, they had to try to figure out a way, how do I get everybody's attention to say the original story is only part of the story, there's more to it. And they tried very hard to use their own newspapers, but they didn't have the audience. And a lot of people just wrote them off as just, you're complaining, you're griping about nothing. And it took a concerted effort in the years, 30 and 40 years after the war, for historical societies in North Carolina and Mississippi and Alabama and Tennessee to start printing their own pamphlets, trying to come up with a counterattack on Pickett's charge. They want to call it Pettigrew's charge or Longstreet's assault or something else. And they're going to try very hard to correct history, but then they go a little bit too far. If you have Pickett's charge here and the rest of the story down here, what they were originally aiming for was to bring it up to, here's the full story. After a certain point, they got carried away and started going in this direction. And like, Pickett's men aren't even there, and they ran. Let's tell the story of Pettigrew's men and, oh, those other guys. And it would go precisely the other way. And why are they doing it? Are they interested in correcting history? There's a little bit of that, but it's, well, we've been slammed long enough. Our states were important, too. Our unit was near the front. My regiment went farther than anybody else's. And it's something that still continues even today. There are folks in several of those states other than Virginia who as recently as, well, in the last 15 years, put monuments on the battlefield and tried to put them much farther ahead of the Virginians' line so that they could say, in fact, not only were we there, we went farther than the Virginians.
Which was more reliable as a historian looking at primary documents such as a diary or a letter versus a newspaper account?
Neither. One of the things that I've learned is that the most difficult thing to write as a military historian is to try to reconstruct the small elements of a battle. Hardly anybody was in a position to see much of anything in the heat of battle. Think about a car accident when you're trying to describe everything that happened. You might get little snippets of things that happened, but under the stress and strain of the event, you might not remember them in the right sequence. You might not remember what connects A to B, but there seems to be a logical connection, so you just sort of write it in. And that's what you end up getting in a lot of diary entries and letters. And even when the correspondent comes and asks you what you saw.
So it's really not much better than criminal eyewitness testimony.
It's almost like CSI, only you're looking at the past. You have to find the evidence, and sometimes the evidence doesn't exist. There's a point after which you have to be able to say there might be several possible different outcomes past this point. One of my favorite soldiers is a soldier in the 24th Michigan Infantry who was talking about when they were dedicating their monument. We're on this spot, at least we think we're on this right spot, because we were too busy at the time to jot it down in our mental memorandum book. And there's something about that phrase, your mental memorandum book, that really sums up an awful lot of the challenge here. Some people filled them up and some people didn't put much there.
You know, there's a diary entry that was featured in Ken Burns' documentary series on the Civil mm-hmm. War, and it's June of 1863, and the soldier writes, I was killed.
Mm-hmm.
That's his last entry.
Almost any Civil War battle is going to have one or two stories by soldiers who have premonition of death. And everybody's going to remember, well, he thought this was it. Trouble is, if you keep looking through, you're going to find that from a lot of soldiers who come through perfectly fine. And so you can't read too much more into that.
Well, that brings me to the question, how do we know how many died, especially when so many of the accounts are unreliable?
We're never going to have all the numbers. The number 620 or 625,000 that held for so long was always had sort of a secret little asterisk after it, because some of the state's records, especially in the former Confederacy, records got destroyed. Some of the projects I've worked on, I've had to go and try to find the story of soldiers, and especially regiments from Alabama and a few others, and find out that an awful lot of the records are incomplete, and we have no way of checking on casualties. Gettysburg's the last one with fairly good documentation.
52,000 men are believed to have died there.
But then when you get to the battles in 64, whether you're with Sherman's army in Georgia or the Union army fighting Lee in Virginia, the fighting begins on the 4th of May and continues almost every day until the middle of June. How do you keep records on something like that? They don't have the infrastructure or anything of the sort. And so many soldiers just fell by the wayside. The army has moved on. There are literally thousands of families, North and South, who after the war could only say, well, the letters stopped coming at the end of May, and never knew what happened after that.
How hard is it to dispel something that gained almost mythic proportions as Pickett's charge did?
I'm not sure you ever actually do, is what it comes down to. The Park Service will try as valiantly as they possibly can. And if you take a look at their signage, they have tried to keep current with the modern scholarship. They will talk about Pettigrew's attack. They will try very hard to educate. That's one of their main goals. But, you know, first impressions are hard to erase. And if Pickett's charge is already in your mind, a National Park Service
as the
sign,
climax of the climax, Gettysburg, of course, is known as the turning point in the Civil War.
And that's kind of been a concocted story, too.
So,
So it just gets very difficult to eradicate a first impression.
You know, it's interesting because if it were that critical, why did they fight two more years?
You just sort of have to look and see how that whole concept began. Right after the Battle of Gettysburg was over, it's the first time that the Union Army has won a big battle. They're going crazy. I mean, the headline in the Harrisburg paper and a Philadelphia paper are talking about Gettysburg, and the headline has a big American flag and the phrase, Waterloo eclipsed. This is a big, big deal. And so it's not all that surprising that with all kinds of hyperbole and literary excess, you're going to see people writing things about the high water mark or the turning point without ever even having any idea of how much more time it's going to take. And later on, those quotes are kind of, they're catchy, they catch on. And then when you have your first entrepreneurial group coming to Gettysburg wanting people to come visit, well, there are a lot of battlefields. Why should we go to Gettysburg? Well, Union victory, Northern soil, more casualties than any other battle. And we might as well add in, you know, Lincoln came here, and it was the turning point of the war. And it all gets in there some way or another. And really, historians today try to get people to think a bit more deeply about that, to get them to pull away from just looking at 3 days at Gettysburg to putting it back into the broader context of the entire war and say, you're really not serving yourself very well by focusing on Gettysburg as a turning point when there might be political turning points, economic turning points, social, diplomatic, all kinds of points where all of a sudden there's a bit of sea change. And if we're going to understand something as complex as a war, we have to get away from one little spot in the middle of South Central Pennsylvania.
Except on the other hand, it's a very important place in terms of an emotional touchstone, and there have been reunions there that have brought back and really provided a place of honor for both the North and the South.
It's kind of related to an issue that's very big right now, and that is the issue of the Confederate flag. The very first reunion that was ever suggested for the Gettysburg battlefield was going to be held in July of 1887, the 24th anniversary. And it wasn't supposed to be a grand event. It was supposed to be a limited meeting between the survivors of the Philadelphia Brigade that held the Union line, the center of the Union line, and the Pickett's Division Association veterans, mostly from Richmond, who were some of Pickett's men who broke the line right there. So we're just talking about a fairly small number of individuals, but the men who held the line and the men who broke the line were the only groups that were really talking about this meeting. The Philadelphians were trying to organize it. And one of the things that they considered doing as a way to lure the Virginians to come back north to a place where they'd been defeated, you really have to put a lot on the table to make that work, they thought that they would get some of the Confederate flags that were captured at Gettysburg with the idea of returning them as a sign of goodwill at this reunion, and that perhaps that inducement would make it easier for the Virginians to agree to come. When word got out that not only the Philadelphians had made the request, but Grover Cleveland and his administration were considering it in a positive way, well, parts of the North explode. The governor of Ohio was a Union veteran, very active in veteran politics, And he just erupted, and he and a few folks like himself were going out there saying, "May God palsy the tongue whoever uttered such a heresy," and things like that.
But I wonder, bringing up the Confederate flag, how far should we go in reining in the Confederate flag symbol?
That has a lot of history about it. Right now, the most well-known, the most well-accepted construct that we think of when we look at the Confederate flag is one very much centered on the civil rights movement and the concept of race. And for the modern generations, that is the one they know. That's what they see. And there are many circumstances where it's probably, well, it is a good thing to tone down the Confederate flag, take them down. As a historian, though, talking about this one reunion, there are other ways of looking at the Confederate flag. And this one that I was setting up gave us our first Confederate flag controversy. And it wasn't between North and South. It was between two elements of Northern veterans, those who said, "We're not giving the flags back," and the others who said, "Let it go. They're our brothers, and now we can promote reconciliation." Race was not part of that discussion. Whenever they talked about the flags, the rhetoric was very specific about, you know, preserving the Union and that sort of thing. And the Southerners were saying, "We didn't ask for them back." And even Jefferson Davis came out and said, "They lost their meaning at Appomattox."
You know, there's so much misinformation about the Civil War almost hardwired into our brains. And so if you could dispel one myth or misperception, what would it be?
Well, right now, probably the big one is the discussion about what were the causes of the Civil War. And we have individuals who will say that it's slavery.
That it was slavery, right.
And others who will say absolutely adamantly, no, it was not. And I'm very much on the slavery side of things. And it's not one of those things that I'm arguing from the fact that I'm a Northerner or anything of the sort. If I'm a historian, I'm about evidence. Take a look at the ordinances of secession for each of the states. And the language is very specific. They might mention that, you know, the right of the state is being abridged by the federal government, but the specific right that they're talking about is slavery repeated over and over again in a variety of different ways. That's probably the one that's causing historians the greatest heartburn at the moment.
You mentioned earlier just how critical battlefields are in terms of putting our U.S. history together. How concerned are you that we are losing more and more battlefields, and every year there's a little bit more fragmentation? Mm-hmm. And why do these battlefields matter?
You know, the historian in me wants to say every square foot is valuable because it has some kind of lesson. It helps us understand what the armies went through. We realize that the armies are made up of real human beings that have families, that there are so many stories that get lost with every acre that's paved over or that we lose. But I live in Gettysburg, and the practical reality is there is always a tension between the past and the present and the future. And every time a piece of ground gets saved for history, it's also ground that's taken off the tax rolls. But a lot of good work is being done to take possession of key battleground to make sure that something essential isn't lost. My larger concern at this point is making sure that those fields are used to the greatest advantage to educate as they possibly can. My friends at Gettysburg do as much as they can with surprisingly little, and the folks at Antietam do amazing amounts with even less. And there's so much history to be told. There are so many lessons that can be told. They're wonderful classrooms, but they need the assets to do it.
And on that note, we are out of time. Thank you, Carol Reardon, for talking with us.
You're quite welcome.
That was Carol Reardon, a professor of American history at Penn State and the author of Pickett's Charge in History and Memory. Her newest book is A Field Guide to Gettysburg. For more information about our guests, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.